Hey, this is Tommy. Before we get started with today's episode, I want to remind everyone that I'm doing a Southbound Live event on the future of Charlotte on March 28th at WFAE Center for Civic and Community Engagement. The featured panelists are Charlotte City Planner Allison Craig, Cheris Blackman of the Westside Community Land Trust, and Monique Douglas of the arts group The Brooklyn Collective. Come join us for a lively discussion. Tickets and more info available at wfae.org/charlotteforward.
What makes country country? English, Irish, and Scottish ballot forms, plus Black influences and instruments and sounds and aesthetics, plus evangelical Christianity.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. If you were listening to country radio in the 90s, at some point you were bound to hear this.
Phone rings, baby cries, TV diet lies. Good morning, honey.
That's Trisha Yearwood's 1994 hit, X's and O's, An American Girl. It became a historic moment in country music because Alice Randall, who co-wrote the song, is Black. And so she became the first Black woman to get writing credit on a number one country hit. Randall has written tracks for artists such as Glen Campbell and the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, as well as novels and screenplays. Now she's written a memoir coming out April 9th called My Black Country. It's about her harsh upbringing in Detroit, where she first fell in love with country music, her rocky first years in Nashville, and her eventual breakthrough. The book has a companion album of the same name, with Randall's songs being interpreted by a new generation of Black singers with country roots, from Rhiannon Giddens to Idea Victoria to Allison Russell. You might have noticed that the Black influence on country music has come to the surface recently in a couple of big cultural moments. I can't think of anybody more suited to talk about them and her own life in country than Alice Randall. Here's our conversation. Alice Randall, it feels like this book is exceptionally well-timed because there's been a lot of stuff going on with Black country over the last few months. And I want to get your thoughts on two things real quick before we dive in deeper into your book. So the first one is Tracy Chapman and Fast Car. You know, Tracy had this big hit in the 80s with Fast Car. I think it made number 6 on the pop charts. Luke Combs covered it last year, and it made number 1 on the country charts, which I think made some people uneasy that in some sense his song reached higher than hers did, at least chart-wise. But then they performed together on the Grammys.
I remember when we were driving in your car. Speed so fast, it felt like I was gone. City lights lay out before. Your arm felt nice right around.
Seemed to be something that everybody enjoyed and was moved by a lot. I'm wondering how all that has landed on you.
I think the Tracy Chapman, who is one of my favorite songwriters, Luke moment, was a great moment for a very polarized America, that we are approaching a presidential election with a lot of dissatisfaction all around from every corner, where a time in our lives where the far right and the far left are very far apart. And here we have two people who come from different worlds, different eras. We don't even have to look at race and gender, just decades, making a statement that has echoed across those decades. And it helps us find that common human cause. I'm always interested in one of my biggest themes, and I think it's a Southern theme, multiple meanings of singular text. The text of the song Fast Car means something different to different people in different decades with different identities. But what's significant is it means a lot to people with a lot of different identities. So I love that moment.
More recently, just in the last, I guess on Super Bowl Sunday, Beyonce released a couple of new songs that I think are meant to be basically the trailer for a country album she's going to do. One of those songs, Texas Hold'em.
This ain't Texas. Woo! Ain't no hold'em. Hey! So lay your cards down, 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 down.
Went straight to number one on the country charts immediately. But I think there was, in the middle of that, some uneasiness and some indecision from some country radio stations and folks like that about whether to qualify that or whether to classify that as a country song.
With these two songs that are dropped at the Super Bowl, I do think they're country songs, and I think they're important country songs. And of the two, the one I love the most for me is 16 Carriages.
16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride with my dreams away to the...
And 16 Carriages is in conversation with multiple other country songs. For example, it's in conversation with 16 Tons, another work song. It's in conversation with my own X's and O's, a song about balance between love and money. It's in conversation with Strawberry Wine and The Lost of Innocence. And most importantly, it's in conversation with Will the Circle, May the Circle Be Unbroken, a song about death. It's elegiac and it's significant. But Texas Hold'em is also a song that is very much a country song. In my new book and on my new album, My Black Country, the Alice Vandal songbook, one of the things that you realize is some of the basics of what makes country country is this idea. Life is hard. God is real. The road, family, and liquor make great compensations for the fact that life is hard. Texas Hold'em, when it's talking, it is talking about life is not a game. And what it means by that to me, that's all that evangelical Christianity. Another way I talk about and thing you see on the album, what makes country country, English, Irish, and Scottish ballad forms, plus Black influences and instruments and sounds and aesthetics, plus evangelical Christianity. When she's talking in that song about Texas Hold'em, life is not a game, that is all up in evangelical Christian truth. And the compensation of making love and being involved with nature, nature in that song is represented by the tornado and the honey. That is more of that compensation and the family. I like grown-up music. All these songs of rock and roll about chasing women, chasing men, chasing people. What is it like when you're 10 years in, 7 years in, 30 years in? Texas Hold'em to me feels like some in it love, not some chasing it love. When I came to Nashville in 1983, one of the things I wanted to see, one of the things I was working to see, was a Black woman at the top of the country charts, singing. And now I can retire.
Let's get to your book. I'm interested in the way you described that country music before as Celtic ballads, African influences, evangelical Christianity. I think most country music fans have probably... are familiar with the first one and the third one. But your book is about that middle part, the African influences, the African-American influences, all those sorts of things. There are two people who come up time and time again in your book who I want to ask you about and kind of get you to tell their stories a little. The first one, I think maybe hardcore country fans will know, but most people probably won't. Could you tell people a little bit about D. Ford Bailey?
Yes, I can tell people about D. Ford Bailey. And one of the things I want to tell people too is if you want to hear D. Ford Bailey like he's never been heard before, he's sampled on this our version of X's and O's on the CD that my daughter is singing. And that is so perfect for the story I'm about to tell you. D. Ford Bailey is the Opry's first star. first superstar. He's not the Opry's first Black star. He is the first star of the Opry. He sang on WSM Barn Dance, and many people define the first moment of Black country, I define it as 1927 December, when he is singing Pan American Blues on WSM. So Dee Ford is an Opry star. He's going to launch a lot of other careers. He plays primarily the harmonica, but he also plays the banjo. And very significantly, his grandfather was also an extraordinary player. And before, he comes from a tradition of what he called Black hillbilly singers. So Dee Ford will live in Nashville, help make the Opry, through complicated business dealings and intersections that have to do with copyright, battles between ASCAP and BMI, and perhaps the rise of a certain specific kind of business racism. Dee Ford is pushed off of the Opry. But in my book, you will discover that that's not the end of Dee Ford's story.
So the second person I want to ask about is someone who probably is even lesser known, at least among country music fans, although she probably has a huge influence in other types of music as well, and that is Lil Hardin.
Yes. Well, Lil Hardin was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and she came to Fisk to go to school when she was a young woman, very young woman. And she will play on Blue Yodel Number 9. This is a song that Johnny Cash has said called the most iconic country song of all time.
Standing on the corner, I didn't mean no harm. Along come a police, he took me by the arm.
And in fact, there were two great Black geniuses on Blue Yodel Number 9, and one was Lil Hardin, the other was Louis Armstrong, and then there was Jimmy Rogers. So people do not understand that Blue Yodel Number 9, this iconic country song, is a Black country song. Baked into the mix is Black genius. But Johnny Cash show, Johnny invites Louis Armstrong on. This is the 60s. I love the Johnny Cash show. He invites Louis Armstrong on to talk about Blue Yodel Number 9. And they talk about how important that day was. They talk about that session. And they leave Lil out of the story. And this is what's so interesting. And some people ask me, why do you only have women on your album? The reason I only have women on the album is women have been excluded in far more universal and profound ways from Black country space than men have been. From Charlie Pride, Ray Charles, Darius Rucker, so many Black men have actually, starting with Dee Ford Bailey, been able to make a public space for themselves as acknowledged superstars in country. Black women, up until this moment, have been excluded from that recognition and from those spaces.
All this now comes back around to you. And you were born in Detroit, but born to a family from Alabama. Who were the ones in your family who sort of helped you lock into country music?
My mother, my grandmother, and my aunt were very different women. And they only had one thing in common, and it should have been loving me, but it wasn't, because my mother didn't love me. But my mother, my grandmother, and my aunt all love country music. They love different country music. My grandmother loved the songs in Air, May the Circle Be Unbroken, My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean, She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain. My mother loved the honky tonk radio songs. And my beloved Aunt Mary Frances loved Ray Charles, modern sounds in country and Western music. She loved her stereo. I actually heard a tremendous amount of country as a small child in Motown. And I fell in love with it. As I said, the only thing that the three women I was closest to loved in common.
You ended up becoming a country songwriter, but you listened to lots of other music. You describe in the book a lot of Motown, obviously, at the time, a lot of rock at some point, all this kind of stuff. Do you think it's because of those women that you were eventually drawn to do this for a living?
No. I think many things came together to make me a country songwriter. Number one is country songs are basically a literary, lyric-driven form. And I'm actually, I love music. I love to listen to music, but I don't play music, and I don't really, I don't write anything but the simplest tunes. I love language play. I love storytelling. I love sung stories go back to the time of Homer. I've always said that songwriting is the only elemental art, because we know that after birth, many people giving birth, many mothers sing to their own children. So it's something that's going on around the world. So I think I would have been drawn to a lyric storytelling form. So I could have been a hip hop writer if I had a better sense of rhythm. I like a storytelling form. I also think that's what's interesting about country that drove me to country is country songs to some degree often are about hard people going through hard times. I had a mother who didn't love me. I had some hard times in my life. I was drawn to country. One of the songs that supported me the most in some of my hardest hours was a John Prine song called Angel from Montgomery.
Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can hold on to believe in this living is just a hard way to go.
I was drawn to country because it gave me a map. And I wrote country songs to give other people a map. It's country songs can create that moment when something too hard to bear is transformed into art that then makes the hard bearable.
Do you feel like for you, listening to country music as you were growing up in this very difficult childhood, was it more that it you saw a way out by listening to country music, or was it more that it just felt good to know that other people were going through their own hard times?
It is never good to know that someone else is. For me, that is not a feeling that I am drawn to. I've never wanted anyone else to suffer as I've suffered. And so that is not, and I take no consolation for any circumstances when I hear that someone else has suffered too. That is, I work all my life to make sure that the part that I can influence, that no one goes through what I've gone through. That is not part of it. The part is the realization, the beacon of light, that someone has transformed that into art, that someone took that experience and turned it into something that is other than that experience. One of my themes, and I mentioned it in the book, is I don't want to ever let someone's worst day define my best day.
You say in the book that the South was the only thing that you knew your dad was afraid of.
That was one thing I was hoping we'd talk about.
You obviously moved South. What drew you there, and what made it feel like it might be different for you?
Well, two things. One was, you know, the part of Detroit that I grew up in, I call it Detroit, Alabama. Because everybody was up from Alabama. Literally, not only did we have popsicle trucks on my grandmother's street, there was a watermelon truck that would roll down the street. This is in 60s Detroit. And it would be a big old farm truck. And young boys would be sitting on a stack of watermelons. And they would be calling out, juicy fruit, juicy fruit. And you could buy a nickel, dime, quarter slice. And they would literally cut it for you from the watermelon and hand it to you as the truck was running down the street. You know, skillet cornbread, everything, every sound I heard. You know, my world was, I might as well have been in many respects in Alabama, except, huge except, my grandparents owned their own house, except they could vote, except I went to a fine parochial school, private school, and it was all Black, and it was peopled with Black doctors and lawyers' children, as well as some other people. So that didn't happen in Alabama. My grandmother never even claimed, my father and grandmother both claimed that my father never went to school in Alabama because they beat the Black kids so bad at the local school for Black kids. She wouldn't send her children to it. And two, he had been so defiant in so many ways that facing the South was my defiance, my act of courage that I had, that I embraced. I think of the South as an Afro-Celtic culture, I see how much Black African experiences in the South and Black African, how much aesthetic Blackness is in the South. And I have wanted, I embrace that, and I enjoy being in spaces where there's a varied and large Black population.
Love in his heart and flowers in his hair. Johnny proposed to Sally, yeah. Sally shivered as she said, I'll love you till the day I'm dead.
That was Rhiannon Giddens' version of Sally Ann, a traditional ballad with lyrics rewritten by Alice Randall. Sally Ann appears on the upcoming album My Black Country, a companion to Randall's memoir. When we come back, Randall talks about the creative burst that led to her number one country hit.
At the door, before she let me in, I was telling her the first lines of the song that I heard.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Alice Randall. So you come down to Nashville and you describe in detail in your book sort of your journey into your songwriting career. And early on, you have this meeting with two or three kind of established songwriter types. And they tell you, I want to make sure I have this right. They came back to you and said, you have no talent whatsoever. I think a lot of people would have just got back in their car and drove home after that. What made you not do that?
In the meeting, the man said, you should just go back to wherever you came from. And then he wrote me that letter. That was the day that actually that letter made me, he had drawn a line in the sand and I crossed it. That's that Motown chin-up defiance. That's what happens when you come from Alabama and then get forged in the fiery furnace of Detroit City. You get pretty, we're tough people.
You mentioned all these songs you've written for this, that are on this album and songs you've written over the years. But you've also written novels. You've written tons of articles, probably academic type work as well. I'm wondering, is there some different place in your brain that you go to when you're trying to write lyrics?
Absolutely. I think one of the great, as I'll be 65 in May, I think I mentioned that. One of the great advantages of my writing career, which really started professionally, you know, I was 22, 23 years old, sold my first magazine piece, is that I cross train. Different genres do different things. And I think one of the great advantages I have is because I actively work in multiple genres. I have had, you know, 20 or some more recorded songs. I have published, I believe, 5 novels. I've sold many, many screenplays to major studios. I've also done a cookbook with my daughter and a children's book with my daughter, all of which are things I loved. Each one of these have been love projects. I always say that movies, what I love about writing screenplays, that reductively put, movies are about strange people in a strange moment in their life. Country songs are about ordinary people in an everyday moment. Each of these genres are different. And what I love about country songs and writing song lyrics, I write song lyrics when I'm trying to touch the largest number of people that are not like me. And the people who are like me, who are in some very isolated place, that they are not being reached.
Another thing that I think is really interesting about lyrics and songs as opposed to something like a novel, for example, is that a song can just come to you in this great burst, right? And you describe that in the book about your number one song, X's and O's. Could you just kind of quickly tell the story about sort of how that happened?
Back in the 90s, I had an opportunity to write a movie of the week for CBS about the ex-wives of country stars. And being a songwriter too, I immediately seized on the opportunity to also write the theme song for this CBS movie of the week. That was a backdoor pilot to an ongoing series. It was sort of, X's and O's was teed up to be Nashville long before the wonderful TV series Nashville. So I get this and I decided I could write with anyone I want. I decided to write with the great Matresa Berg. And Matresa and I sit down and we don't get anything good. We just do not get anything good. So I think I'm going to use a country classic because I'm honest. The work was just not, we didn't get it. And I was in my shower feeling like I've let myself down, my publisher down. And then the phone rings. And it's my daughter's school. I have also forgotten to send in a note, something that something she needed in her backpack was not there, that had to be there. It was something that was absolutely required. And I'm thinking, I am a complete failure. I was in the shower, water is coming down on me. I literally thought, you got a picture of your mama and keels and pearls. You're trying to make it in your daddy's world. That it kid. You're not doing it, kid. And I said that again to myself. And I literally, the second time I said it with the failing, I thought, that's my song. You got a picture of your mama and heels and pearls. You're trying to make it in your daddy's world. And some more of it came to me. I got dressed and not very well, dashed my daddy's world. That was only about 5 minutes away by car, I think. And dashed over to Matresa's house. Literally, I don't think I called. I think I banged on her front door. She was living on Blair Boulevard, where my daughter lives now. And at the door, before she let me in, I was telling her the first lines of the song that I heard. Right then, the rest of it comes to her almost as quickly as the first part came to me. Fix the sink, mow the yard really isn't all that hard if you get paid. She just bought this beautiful new house. And she was in this great new marriage with Jeff Hanna of Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. So she's thinking about the love and keeping up the house thing. And I'm thinking about how am I struggling with the baby thing? And before we knew it, we found our common cause. When we got into that bridge, she's got her God and she's got good wine. Aretha Franklin and Patsy Cline are two idols. And we both love both of them. We were singing it. It was like, this was it. How to keep the balance up between love and money. And right when that balance was about to drown me, because part of the reason neither of us could get that writing done, in my opinion, is Matresa and I were both hard up against it, trying to make money. And sometimes when you feel that pressure, it's really hard. And I had a child to raise. Women across this country have that pressure. That song is now a country classic.
You talk about in the book how you basically got hornswoggled out of a lot of your royalties for X's and O's by somebody who was running the publishing company at the time. I wonder now, looking back on that, do you feel like your being Black had anything to do with that? Or whether that was just sort of standard operating procedures to try to separate artists from their money?
What I'd like to say about that is, why the album? Layla Michaela, Alison Russell, Valerie June, Rhiannon Giddens, Reese Palmer, Miko Marks, Adia Victoria, all the women who came together, the 10 women who came together to support my legacy. The most important thing about that actually probably was it healed that terrible wound. Because those women came together and worked on the album. And it wasn't because we were paying them a lot of money, because we didn't. It wasn't because they didn't have anything to do, because they all had big projects of their own. It was a 21st century radical commune of art and healing. It was the ways in which women, Black women, have come to understand that art does heal trauma, individual, public, and personal. And they may not have known what had happened to me, but they knew that it used to be so competitive. Miko and Reese Palmer talk about Miko Marks, who are both in the album, how when they were coming up originally, they were pitted against each other. But we come into a new moment where these young women are leading the charge to work collectively, to rise with each other. And so it's almost like my crazy, bad, abusive mother. I have had such a good relationship with my own daughter. I can hardly remember her. It's not so much that I have forgiven her. It's that I've forgotten these hard things. That whole thing is not as important to me because that was in the last century. And I put my own self responsible for one part of it. Read your contracts. And don't think that business people are your family or your friends. They're business people. The only thing important about that, it was such a traumatic experience. I left the country music business at the height of my success. You get what you negotiate. You don't get what's fair.
What is your favorite moment of hearing one of your songs, just like out in the wild somewhere?
Oh, the absolute favorite out in the wild one was hearing X's and O's at an amusement park with a Trisha sound alike. To be at the Opryland Amusement Park, which is a place that I'd gone when I was in my, 23 years old and just arrived in town, riding the roller coasters, when there sounded like singing your song in this amazing amusement park, that was big.
I have a dream of my own, and it's mine, all mine alone. It's been my friend since I was just a girl.
That was Valerie June singing Alice Randall's song Big Dream from the upcoming album My Black Country. As Alice Randall says and writes in her book, country music was deeply black way before Tracy Chapman and Beyoncé got involved. The black kids in my high school in Georgia knew the latest Ronnie Millsap and Dolly Parton records, just like we white kids knew the Prince and Rick James songs on the radio. Simple songs about complicated feelings. That's something everybody can relate to. And nothing cuts through the fog like a great country song. But black people have been shut out of and pushed away from country music, both as fans and as artists. People like Alice Randall were unicorns on Music Row for decades. Now, though, that's obviously changing. And that change is only to the good. As the brilliant songwriter Harlan Howard said, country music is three chords in the truth. And sometimes that's the best way to express the black experience, same way it is to express the white experience or anybody else's experience. Alice Randall held the door open for a long time. Now, finally, others like her are making their way into the room. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR One app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound at our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.